pieces of literature that we have is found in the let's start. Okay, Jay the Alcoholic, and God's doing for me today what I couldn't do for myself. One of my favorite pieces of AA literature, aside from our big book, and by the way, this is the fourth edition of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're not using it, you're not using the book that the new guy's using. If you're not familiar with the new stories that are in here, how the heck are you going to be of service to somebody who's new in the fellowship? Oh, well, my notes are all in it. Well, put them in the other book. You mean you haven't grown a little bit since then? Just an opinion.
Thanks, Jay.
I came in 1979. The third edition came out in 1978. Nobody was telling me, oh, my big book is better than yours. My stories are better than yours. Oh, page 449. Oh, I don't know. What do they call it nowadays? It's called Acceptance is the Answer is the name of the story in the book. Call it by its right name. Anyway, just a little opinion. And I also got, and I got sober in an AA that wasn't 164 pages. No, it's the whole book. It's the whole book. Just to stir it up a little bit. But another piece of literature that I really like is The Language of the Heart. And in The Language of the Heart, there's some correspondence between Bill Wilson, our co-founder, who in 1961, because a lot of his mentors were had passed, he wrote a letter to Carl Jung. And he, it was regarding the patient that Jung had, whose name was Roland Hazard. And Roland Hazard was the guy who carried the message to the guy that carried the message to Bill. And he was a member of the Oxford group. But he had all the money in the world, and he still couldn't get sober. And anyway, so Bill wrote a letter describing the program, sent some pamphlets and some books to Dr. Jung. And this is the letter that Jung replied. Dear Mr. W., your letter has been very welcome indeed. I had no news from Roland H. anymore and often wondered what had been his fate. Our conversation, which he had adequately reported to you, had an aspect which he did not know. The reason that I could not tell him everything was that though in those days I had to be exceedingly careful of what I said. I found that I was misunderstood in every possible way. Thus, I was very careful when I talked to Roland, but what I really thought about was the result of many my experiences with many men of his kind, alcoholics. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent, on a low level, of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. How could one formulate such an insight in a language that is not misunderstood in our days? The only right and legitimate way to such an experience is that it happens to you in reality. And it can only happen to you when you walk on a path which leads you to a higher understanding. You might be led to that goal by an act of grace, or through a personal and honest contact with friends, or through a higher education of the mind beyond the confines of mere rationalism. I see from your letter that Roland has chosen the second way, which was, under the circumstances, obviously the best. I am strongly convinced that the evil principle prevailing in the world leads the unrecognized spiritual need into danger, if not counteracted either by real religious insight or by a protective wall of human community. An ordinary man, not protected by an action from above and isolated in society, cannot resist the power of evil, which is called very aptly the devil. But the use of such words arouses so many mistakes that one can only keep aloof from them as much as possible. These are the reasons why I could not give a full and sufficient explanation to Roland, but I am risking it with you because I conclude from your very decent and honest letter that you have acquired a point of view above the misleading platitudes one usually hears about alcoholism. You see, alcohol, in Latin, is spiritus, and you use the same word for the highest religious experience as well as for the most depraving poison. The helpful formula, therefore, is spiritus contra spiritum. Thank you again for your kind letter. I remain Carl Jung. So, we need the spirit to go against the spirits of alcohol. And what we do on retreat, or what I believe that we do on retreat, and what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that we form a protective wall of human community. And when a guy comes into the Parker Men's Stag, the first thing we do is we take him and we bring him up over that wall. And we get him in the middle of the pack. And we start to teach him these things by, first it's like an honest contact with friends about, you know, getting comfortable enough to be able to come back to the meeting, and then getting a sponsor, and then going through the steps, which then lead us to this higher understanding that leads us beyond the confines of mere rationalism, beyond just this normal stuff that we walk around in thinking that this is reality. And so I love this. I love this letter. And it's in the language of the heart, or you can Google it. It's on the internet, like just about everything is nowadays. So, the Oxford group, which all the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous were members of the Oxford group. Bill and Lois went to Oxford group meetings the first 3 years of his sobriety. And what it was kind of an evangelical Christian movement. It was not a sect, but it was a group of women and men that had found a way, a set of spiritual exercises that relieved them from their problems. And what they always talked about is that you don't have to believe anything. But what we ask you to do is to make an experiment. What we're asking you to do is make an honest experiment. So this weekend, for the next about 30 hours, 27 hours, because that's all we're going to be together, is I'd like to ask you to make an experiment. And the experiment is this. Let's pretend that God is everything. You don't have to tell anybody. You don't have to define God. But let's just pretend that it's everything. And then come Sunday afternoon, when you go home, before you have the first fight with the wife, because, of course, we've all been out being spiritual. Come home and there's immediately conflict. But anyway, what you do is take a look at what happened in your thinking and in your heart over the course of this weekend. Now, as far as a framework for this retreat, Bill Wilson's mentor in the Oxford group was a guy by the name of Samuel Moore Shoemaker. And Sam Shoemaker's hands are all over the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Guys that he worked steps with were the guys that got the Oxford group started in Akron so that Bill could find a meeting when he was there. And he was a remarkable guy, remarkable, remarkable man. And he said that there are four things that if we're going to have a clear channel to this God as we understand God, if we're going to be able to actually work the 10th and the 11th step, if when we ask for guidance in our day that we're plugged in instead of just running around blind, there are four things which needed putting right in my life. Okay? The first is, is there was a person that I would not forgive. There was a person that I would not forgive. Second, there was a restitution that I would not make. There was a restitution that I would not make. Third, there was a doubtful pleasure that I would not give up. How did he know? Huh? And fourth, there was a sin in the long past that I would not confess. Now again, when I say God, I'm not saying what you think I'm saying. Okay? And I'll be using terms that are, I love this thing about it being medieval language. The word sin comes from the sound of an arrow missing a mark, missing the target. That's what it comes from. So I don't know what it is that you, what kind of baggage you may hang on that word, but anyway, sin is an error in the long past that I would not confess. And then he said, when these things were straightened out, I not only came into a new power and release, but for the first time, I began to get daily guidance, which I knew could be relied upon. Sam was a remarkable, remarkable character. And I have found that this is a great way that if you get a guy that comes to you in crisis, that you can go through. And so during the course of this weekend, we're going to look at these 4 points. So we're a group of men, and probably the most... one of the most important questions that we have is, why did God create women? And in my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I've come up with is so that men would learn to pray honestly. Because there is nothing that brings us to our knees. There is nothing that flattens our ego like the higher power. Okay? So, you know, I talk to you. I come into this Manhattan Beach Club, and I'm running around, and I start working after 30 days, and I start attending bar. And one evening, this creature comes in, and we start running around together. And God's will was operative in my life. A few weeks later, she moves the husband out, gives me the keys to her vet. Obviously, I'm working a very bitchin' spiritual program. And then about 4 or 5 weeks after that, she decides she wants what I really have, and she wants to get sober. And so I bring her to the meetings and introduce her to all the old-timers. Teach her to sit down in the brain damage section in the front where my sponsor had set me. And life is large. You know, I have it so that, you know, we were involved before she came into AA, so it's not like I'm taking advantage of a newcomer, right? And so, anyway, we're going around, we go running around for about 4 months, and then she leaves me for another woman. And brings her to the group. And they sit in the seats that we used to sit in. And I learned that great thing that many of us experience in Alcoholics Anonymous of cruising the parking lot, looking at the cars, trying to decide whether or not we can go into the meetings. I know that doesn't happen, you know, with you guys, but it happens in Southern California. And so I'm just beside myself. I'm just all screwed up. And I go to the Ilano Club, and I'm sitting out front waiting for the club to open, and there's Irish Dan. Now, I don't know how you get sober without Irish Dan. You know, I mean, and Dan had been sober at that time about 30 years. And he says, "What's wrong with you, kid?" So I, you know, was just waiting to be able to once again tell this tale of woe. I've got to, you know, it's like any problem that we have, any problem that we really, you know, that we think we have. There's the 2-minute version. There's the 8-minute version. And then there's the box set. You know, where if you get somebody in the coffee shop, you can give them an hour and a half and you never breathe once, right? Because you don't want them to give you any real experience, strength, and hope. So Dan says, "Well, what's your prayer life like, kid?" "What are you talking about?" You know, I didn't say that. "Didn't you listen to me?" He says, "What's your prayer life like?" "Well," I said, "you know, well, I'm an AA guy. You know, I got like 6 months of sobriety. And so, you know, when I get up in the morning," I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous that prayer was to be honest and to be personal. So when I get up in the morning, what I'm doing is I'm getting down on my knees and I'm going, "Help!" Because I was really, really thirsty for about 4 months. I mean, like every third thought was a drink. And then I'd say the Serenity Prayer 1,800 times during the course of the day. I'd stop at a couple of meetings. I'd say the prayers at the meetings. And when I got home at night, I'd go, "Thanks." Because I couldn't believe that I got home sober. I didn't have anything to drink that entire day. So that's my prayer life. And he says, "Well, kid, you know, the saying the Serenity Prayer 18,000 times is all fine and good," he said, "but we're going to make you a real prayerful man." He says, "You got a job, right, kid?" "Yeah, I got a job." See, I got sober before newcomers had a union. The union started in about 1987. And so like if you even started to talk about a feeling in a meeting or anywhere around Alcoholics Anonymous, an old timer just throw you up against the wall and go, "Do you have a job?" "What?" And he said, "So you got a job, kid, right?" "Yeah, I got a job." And he said, "You're alcoholic, so you drive to work the same way, no matter what, every time, right?" "Yeah, right." He said, "Okay, so this is what I want you to do. I want you to get a God spot. I want you to get a God spot. When you're on your drive to work, I want you to pick a place where you will make a conscious contact. All I want you to do is just say hi. And then when you go home from work, you do the same thing. So I have doubled your prayers right there." It was true. It was true. And an interesting thing, for me, it was when my car would be going down Vista Del Mar and I'd turn, you hit the Pacific Ocean and I'd see the ocean. I'd just go, "Oh, yeah." And I go, "Hi." Now, the great thing about "Hi," so I'm going, "Help! Hi. Hi. Thanks." The nice thing about "Hi" is that it's an invitation to a conversation. And it would not, after a little while, maybe a couple days, it wouldn't stop with just "Hi." And I'd start to think about, like, people that I knew that were having trouble in the meeting. Or about people that I maybe was in conflict in my life. And what it did is it drew me out of myself. Because, see, I am selfish and self-centered. The whole world revolves around me. But that saying "Hi," what it did is it brought me out of myself. This was such a remarkable occurrence that, you know, then a couple weeks later, he got me aside and he said, "How's it going, kid?" "Oh, it's going good." Said, "Okay, now we're going to crank it up a little bit." He said, "Do you ever have any trouble at work?" How did he know? He said, I want you to get, you know how in the boxing ring there's a neutral corner? He said, I want you to get a God spot at work. So I'm 10 and bar at the time. You know, it's not, doesn't really give itself to, you know, dropping to my knees in prayer. And but there was a part over on the rail where I could go, and if I put my hand on it, the big guy and I both knew what I was doing. I was saying, hi, and I might need a little help here. And so all of a sudden, I got this spot at work where I can go. Now, how many of you guys live with other people? Don't live by yourselves, okay? Same thing works in the home. You don't have to tell anybody that when I come over at this windowsill and I go like this, I'm praying. But I know in my heart of hearts, and whatever it is this creative principle is, knows, that what I'm doing is I'm reaching outside of me. So suddenly, I've gone from two periods of prayer that were kind of jackknifed into just me doing something that I really didn't feel comfortable with, to about 8 to 10 times that I was making conscious contact. And that's all it is. That's all it is just being conscious for a moment that there's something going on outside of my mind, which is a pretty stunning stretch. Because when I got here, I was really important to me. And the great thing is that I'm kind of clued into the joke now. Now, another great thing to do is terrorizing new guys with this concept. Now, I'm brutal because I can do it now, you know. They don't swing at me very often. But I like to really fuck with them, and I'll go up and say, you know, I've got a really personal relationship with Jesus. And Jesus has revealed to me that his favorite thing to do is to have a cigarette with a new guy. And I'm absolutely sincere about it. You know, I would never, you know, you drop the Jesus part, but the truth is that every new guy just about smokes, right? And so what you do is you get them to put God or just a G on their cigarette pack. And every time they go out to have a cigarette, that they look and find some place where, you know, because they got to go outside now, and to look and to find a place and to burn one with the big guy. And if a guy smokes 3 packs a day, he's the most prayerful man in the meeting, right? But this is how we draw ourselves out of ourselves. I like to call these stupid God tricks. You know? Because if you do them, something happens. And try it. Try it and see what happens. So that's what my conscious contact is. It's drawing me out of myself. Whatever it is that I can do that draws me out of me. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous meetings are so wonderful. And, you know, meetings are spiritual chemotherapy. They, you know, my disease has no idea what's going on when I go to it. Now, I can't, again, I, you know, it's pre-union AA. So, I had to go to a meeting every day in my first 3 years. Oh, my God. Well, okay. So I got a day off for laundry when I had about 6 months over from my 9-month chip. But what happened is I went to a meeting every day. And in my day, the most important thing that I was doing was going to a meeting. See, to me, Alcoholics Anonymous is the most important thing in my life. Still is. Still is. And so I need to put myself in the consciousness of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what is the consciousness of Alcoholics Anonymous? First and foremost is that we don't have to drink today. And that it is safe here. And are your meetings safe? One of the responsibilities about being a dynamic men's stag is making sure that when you're at the mixed meetings, that the predators know that we know who they are, and that we make sure that our meetings are safe for our sisters. That's our responsibility. And that when we're out and about, that we are looking for how it is that we are able to carry this message and make sure that the environment is safe for men and women to come into and recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So, is it safe here? Now, this is our first retreat. And it's so what we're doing this weekend is amazingly important. Because what we're doing here is we're establishing a consciousness that will go on from here to October to next year, you know, on and on and on. And we need to make sure that this is a safe place here. So I'm going to implore you that what is said here stays on this mountain. Unless the other man that's involved, you know, the person that's involved gives his permission. Because we're going to be doing some important spiritual exercises up here, and it needs to be safe. And, you know, our co-founder, Dr. Bob, you know, he had like a 5-minute talk, his last talk, and one of the things he said was, is that we have to watch out for gossip. And what is gossip? Gossip is any conversation that I have about somebody that's not in the room. You know, so we have to be careful with, I mean, as long as we know what we're doing, you know, but let's be conscious about this. So is this a safe place here? Now, yeah, thank you. This weekend, what we're going to do is we're going to be doing some self-examination. And we're going to be doing some sharing. Now, you don't have to, you know, bust out anything that you don't want to. But there are some things sometimes when they're shared at a group level that, if it's safe, that it's very, very helpful. That's even, you know, there's one thing about doing it with your sponsor. But if we share it at a group level, we may find out that we're not quite as unique as we think. Sam Shoemaker said that there's only one sin. There's only one mistake. And that's believing that I am different. There's only one mistake, believing that I am different. One of the reasons that I believe that alcoholism is a disease more today than I did when I came in is the fifth steps that I've heard. And believe me, I have heard a number of them. And they're all the same. I mean, we're alcoholic males. We're just not that creative. You know, I mean, the shock for our sisters is finding out how truly shallow we are. Some of us may be a little more flamboyant than others, but we all destroy ourselves in exactly the same way. So, what I would like to do is, what we need to do is we'll get together and we'll talk a little bit about, see, in a room of alcoholic men, there is a tremendous amount of pain that's in this room. And that can be left here, or a piece of it can be left here. So, like, first of all, we're going to get together in small groups, and I'd like you to share about why are you here? share about whether or not you believe that this place is safe, that you're willing to make a commitment, a spiritual commitment to making this place safe, not just for you, but for alcoholics for generations to come. My home group's retreat, we've been at our current location for 15 years, I think. And it's a spinoff from a retreat house that closed, and that retreat's been going for over 45 years. And then the other thing is there something that you'd like to leave here? Now, what is it that I wish was not true about myself? A friend of mine taught me that how do you know that you're living in God's will? If I can tell my daughter, my wife, and my sponsor what's going on at this moment. For me, what I wish wasn't true about myself is that occasionally, I know this doesn't happen to any of the men in the Parker men's stag, but on occasion, when I'm on the internet, I end up at sites that I can't even defend to myself, much less to the people that I love. It violates my wife's trust. It makes it so that my computer is not a safe place for her to go, and it, my computer's in our home. I'm real good about dropping it for a period of time, and then every now and then I'll pick it up again, and I know that it isn't anything that people get strung out on, but I'll go on a run for a few weeks with it, and I feel horrible about it. And that's the thing that of everything in my life, like I say to new guys, if you think I'm full of shit, come and spend the day with me. See how I treat my wife. See how I treat my employer. See how I treat my cat. See how I treat my daughter. You know, but of everything that's the thing that I'm most embarrassed about who I am and my personal conduct. Okay? And I would like to be able to leave that here. So, again, you don't have to drop this out loud to anybody up front, but if you want to share about that, you can. Now we're going to get to the most difficult part of the retreat, which is that we're going to count off. This is really, really hard because I'm thinking about me the whole time they're counting, and then when it gets to me, I'm still thinking of me. So, and we're going to get together in small groups. We're going to get together in small groups. Hopefully you won't be, you know, hanging out with your Goombas because, again, we're creating a different dynamic. There's 8 groups. You know, you can go outside. There's some small rooms. You can go upstairs. You can put a couple of groups in here. Spend about 45 minutes. I figure if we've got 8 groups of 8, you know, that everybody can share in an hour easily, and then we'll come back here at is that at 11? At 11:15. So you got time to smoke. You got time to share. And then we'll be back here at 11:15. So,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
No.
It was a rough night last night.
3, 7, 8, 1. I'm now going to introduce you to my fabulous wife, Adele. You're going to hear a lot about her this weekend because the great fact is that I have a sober home, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And she's brilliant. She's aside from a lot of things about her. She's a columnist, and she has a way of putting things in words that's really cool. So along the weekend, I'm going to read you a few columns from her, of hers. The television and radio have been turned off in our home and my car for a month now. Coincidentally, during that time, I have not been afraid. As a lifelong television watcher and noise addict, I began to watch my television habits change a number of years ago. My husband Jay killed his television before and seldom watched the several I brought into the relationship. He was, thank goodness gracious, during the years of my incessant watching and simply left the room when I grabbed the remote. Sometimes I turned on the TV so that he would leave. He eventually figured that out, but he was kind nevertheless. Some years ago, my compulsion to watch primetime television dropped away. For many years, I had found daytime television to be loud and violent and frankly ridiculous, and the commercials unbearable and even louder. I learned that the volume of commercials is turned up. Yet I watched Jerry Springer or Judge Judy or whatever fit the where did those people come from paradigm, as if my head were craned toward a freeway accident, knowing that gawking was inappropriate, but not able to stop. Then I turned the channels to cable TV and started watching better nonsense for a few more years. I found myself thinking that I ought to know what was going on in the world, so I watched CNN too. Concurrent to the television experiment, I increased my exposure to spiritual books, workshops, tapes, and CDs of spiritual teachings. Joel Goldsmith, Barbara Mole, Eckhart Tolle, and Byron Katie, to public radio. I had long before abandoned network radio, but mostly I listened to the radio. Interestingly enough, I began to correlate my anxiety to what I was listening to and watched it decrease during the discussion of spiritual truth. Though spending most of my radio time listening to wonderful shows like This American Life and LA Theater Works Radio Theater, I often listen to the BBC and National Public Radio News. I found the reporting deeper and coverage at much higher quality level. Something in me still believed I was supposed to be apprised about what was going on in the world. The discovery I made, however, was that constant intake of broadcast news, however reported, instilled in me a river of fear, one drop at a time. 2 years ago, I stopped watching the news completely. About the same time, I limited my watching to HBO, Showtime, IFC, and the Sundance Channel. Still, I turned the television on whenever things got quiet. I felt lonely or I felt bored. I surmised that Sex in the City and The Sopranos were more artistic than American Idol and felt appropriately superior. Jay learned never to approach the bedroom between 8 and 10 o'clock on Sunday nights. This summer, I watched myself spend hours in bed watching TV. Although I had many, many things to do, I couldn't get up to do them. If I did get up, I brought my projects to the television or the television to the projects. I watched and watched myself do that and recognized at some point that I was powerless to do anything else. Thinking I should stop, or judging my behavior as bad or good or lazy or whatever, was less than useless. It actually produced more of the undesired effect. And there I stayed for 2 months, watching the television from my bed and observing myself. Then one day in July, I didn't turn on the TV. It's been off since. Perhaps I'll turn it on again one day, but the need to is gone. I find that remarkable. During those hours frozen to the television, I discovered that the story of my life has been about my attempts to postpone now. I attempted to do that with activity, radio, paralysis, and particularly television. I did it because I was afraid of what this moment now might contain, that it would not be good enough, that it should be different, and so on. So I tried to make now stop. Because now, the only thing that ever is impossible to stop, I ended up merely distracting myself. In doing so, I missed the joy of being. Life is a process of awakening. Until a certain level of awakening me had already taken place, the television and the radio had to be blasting. I understand that and am simply grateful now for the shift. It's amazing how beautifully long a day is when one is in it. Kill your television. The only reason that sports exist is to sell us beer and trucks. Okay. So I was talking a little while ago about meetings. Why I go to meetings. Why do I go to meetings? Well, this creative principle, this God as I understand God, the universe or whatever, knows that I'm a fairly busy guy. And that, but God, as I understand God, knows that on Monday night I'm at the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. On Tuesday evenings, there's a meditation group for men at my house. We spend a half hour listening to a spiritual teacher, Eckhart Tolle, and then we spend a half an hour being silent together. Wednesday nights, I'm at my spiritual teacher's house, going through a tape series with him. And a group of friends, a group of women and men. Thursday nights, I'm at the 11-step group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I'm usually involved in some kind of service activity along these lines. But God doesn't have to even think about where to find me, because it knows. Oh, it's Thursday, the 11th step. When I was 13 years sober, I hit a wall in my... Up until then, I was sober man, armed with steps, concepts, and traditions, able to transcend any life situation with the application of the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I used to be that that when I went to speak at AA meetings or when I was called to participate, I was so serious, man, I made the paint crack. Because lives are on the line here. Untreated alcoholism running through Alcoholics Anonymous. We need to stop it. You have a slip here. Give him to me. I'll save his life. And there was nothing I hated more than some dried up old geek in Alcoholics Anonymous that'd say, well, he'll get around to doing it when he'll get around to doing it. I thought those people were killing people in AA. But after about 3 decades with you, they'll do it when they're going to do it. I got involved with a woman. You know, I got involved with a woman when I was just over a year sober, and Jacqueline, and she was hopping cocktails at the bar that I was working at, and we ended up getting married, and it was very, very interesting being married to somebody that wasn't sober, and after a little while, she wouldn't drink much, because she's living with sober man. And she'd make denigrating things about when I'd go off to my meetings. And once or twice a week, she'd just go out and blow off some steam with her friends. Didn't look like alcoholism to me. Then I made a, don't ever do this, okay? Say, darling, you know when you eat that Valium, it kind of changes the way that you are? Because she quit cold turkey and got really angry. Quit doing those freeze-dried martinis. And we, after another couple of years, it just was obvious that we were going to have to split to me. Now, I'd been raised in a family that had been split, so I was never going to, you know, for me to get divorced, it was just not going to happen. And I knew that this was what was up, and I was going on retreat, and I went up on retreat, and on that retreat, I told the truth to the guys about what was going on. And I turned my will and my wife over to the care of God as I understood God while I was up there. And the most amazing thing happened. She started going to the Al-Anon family groups a couple days later. 6 months later, she came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's 23 years sober now. And Jacqueline, when she got sober, it was really wonderful. I was 6 years sober at the time almost. And I got to go back to the meetings, go to 7 meetings a week as secretary of the big speaker meeting in our neighborhood. I got more sponsees between about 1984, the year before she got sober, in 1987. I probably did the best work I ever did in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, we were out there. We were picking the liquor stores and singing AA hymns, man. We were on fire, you know, and it was a wonderful thing. And, you know, if you haven't been on fire, you know, ask yourself why. Now, I know that this men's stag group's full of a bunch of guys that are on fire, and that's what we do, man. We run together. We feed off each other. And, but Jacqueline and I were not well suited. She'd been raised in a home that there never was a man. So she had no idea what we're like, you know, which is really, you know, awful. And then physically, we weren't able to be really intimate much after she stopped drinking. And at first, we didn't know about this. This was back in the mid-80s. And the truth was is that she'd been sexualized as a child. And she didn't have any memory of that. And then when she got sober, when we'd start to become intimate, her body would, and neither of us understood what was going on. And then when she became pregnant, when we decided to have a child, all of that came up, and that tends to be a pattern. About 75% of our sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous have been sexualized young or against their will when they were young people. And, you know, if we're going to make sure that Alcoholics Anonymous is a safe place, we have to make sure that we're safe and we know what we're doing when we're out dating our sisters and to know what's up. And so just an idea of that. And it's amazing now, as time goes on, about how many of our brothers have had the same types of experiences. And so that's one of the reasons why we need to also really watch the way that we talk about people that have other, shall we say, lifestyles in our meetings. And you know, one of the tragedies about my stag meeting, because we're a good bunch of men, is that we only have maybe 1 to 2 gay guys in our meeting, and we never seem to get many more than that. And it's a shame that that our meeting is not a larger expression of God. Just an opinion. But so anyway, at 13 years sober, my marriage ended. And Jackie and I, we both had sponsors. My sponsor, Greg, said at the time, he said, "You're leaving your marriage so you can go to get in a relationship." I'd been by Jackie. I'd stayed with her while she went through all the sexual recovery work and all that stuff. But it had reached the point where I just couldn't hack it anymore. And what I was able to do is I was able to sit down at the table and say to her, I can't live like this anymore. And Sober Man, the guy who'd founded the couple's retreat, the guy who'd been talking about the application of spiritual principles, being able to transcend anything, it hit a wall. And so one of the things that I did was I went back into the steps with a group of guys. I was coming up on 14 years sober, and I wanted to do something special to get ready for 15. And so I got together a group of guys, and we went through the book together, that all guys that I'd sponsored over the years that were still sober. And if you haven't done that, if you haven't gone through the book with a group of guys, it's really fun to do. And there's a lot of formats out there. Are they correct? Well, you know, it's just a way of looking at things one way or another. I enjoy using the Dr. Paul's thing that he got from the guys down in Texas, The Unofficial Guide to the Steps. I've used Herb Kagan's book. I've got friends that give me these things, and I just try them, you know. I mean, why not? But this Unofficial Guide to the Steps has a really good inventory process in it. And so I use that. And not when I take a guy through in the beginning, but, you know, in a group. And one of the things that was really fun to watch was this group of, I think there were 14 of us when we started, 11 of us actually did the work. A year and a half after we finished, nobody's relationship was the same. Nobody's business was the same. They were still in the same relationships or their businesses, but none of our lives resembled what they were before. And it was really fun to watch that power in that many people instead of just one-on-one. Sometimes you get to the point that you just go, you know, I mean, I'm so used to seeing another man transform and getting that insight. But to see it across the board like that was really, really wonderful. The other two guys that didn't do it, they're still sober. Imagine that. You know, they just didn't do things correctly with the group. And another man was able to die sober, die consciously. And so I ended up with this fabulous creature, Adele. And we'd been running around for a little while, and she started to get these migraines, and I couldn't understand why, what was happening, and neither could she. And then one day she pulled up to the coffee bar that I owned. I'm one of these people that when I was 10 years sober, I went back and reviewed my life, wanted to follow my bliss, and looked about, you know, when was I happiest in my life so that I could then, you know, follow that as a career path. And when I did that inventory for me, I was happiest when I was selling stimulants to college students. So this was 1989, 1990, and the coffee thing was just starting to percolate up in Seattle, and so I went and I bought a coffee bar, and I put it on a college campus, and I went back. And my business card for years said, Jay Stinnett, purveyor of fine stimulants. But anyway, she rolled up to the coffee bar, and she just fell out of the car. And we got her to the hospital, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. And all they were doing was medicating her. Every 6 hours when the narcotics would wear off, they'd hit her again. Because the minute they'd start to wear off, it was like Torquemada was working on her. She just got in more and more progressive pain. Now I've just opened this coffee bar, and I'm trying to be a good dad to my daughter when I got her, and I'm sponsoring a bunch of people, and I'm stretched. But see, I'm the kind of guy that I don't get to make a decision whether or not I go to the meeting. If it's Monday night, I'm at the Stag. And if it's Thursday night, I'm at the 11-step group. And if it's Tuesday night, guys are coming to my house. And if it's Wednesday night, I'm over here, unless there's something that, you know, that gets in the way of that. And so Adele's in this hospital, and I'm going up to the hospital, and I'm stretched, and I don't know what to do. And it's Thursday night, and I really should be taking care of myself, doing something for me, but it's Thursday, so I go to my meeting. And I'm there, and there's a woman who's taking a cake, and she doesn't know why she's there either. She didn't feel like going to the meeting, but she's going to come and take her cake. And so she asks how Adele is, and I tell her, and she says, that doesn't sound right. She says, tell you what, let me make a call. I got a friend who works up at the UCLA Med Center. Maybe we can get her in there. And we were able to do that. And I got up there, and I got her out of the hospital that she's in, and I get her in the car, and I get to drive her up to the hospital. And when we get up there, they went, she didn't come in an ambulance. This is obviously an insurance dump. We're not going to admit her. And the meds are wearing off. And we're in the admitting area. And there's a lot of people. And I don't know what to do. So I go around the corner and I say, hey, big guy, I need some help now. And then I did the next indicated thing. I called this woman up that had recommended. I come down. She made a couple phone calls, and the chief neurologist actually came down off the floor into the admitting area. And fortunately, I had the pictures with me, the brain scan, and he looked at it and he said, this woman's not suffering from migraines. She's had strokes. Admit her immediately. And they admitted her. A couple days later, they did this exotic brain surgery where they went up their carotid artery and collapsed the vein that was blocked and was causing all the pain with glue. And then they couldn't figure out why it is that a woman that was 35 years old was having strokes. And they started looking around at her, and they found that she had a tumor in her heart. And so the day before Thanksgiving, they cracked her open, and they took it out, put her back together. And I like to say that aside from the marriage that she's locked into, that she's recovered fairly well. But if I hadn't been at the meeting, how would we ever have gotten to the point where we'd get to where somebody could help her? So one of the things that I need to do is I need to pay attention to what's going on in my life. That's what living prayerfully is. You know, I need to pay attention to what's going on in my life. It's like when Jacqueline and I, we were trying to, Jacqueline decided when she got sober that one of the things she wanted to do was she wanted to have a child. Well, great. Sounds like a wonderful, opportunity for me, so I'm all for it. And we weren't getting pregnant. And then I got a phone call and one of my sponsees says, get up here, would you? And I go running up to the hospital, and he just had a child born. Timmy Bannis' son, Danny, was born. And I got to walk into the room maybe 20 minutes after the baby was born. And I'd never been in that before, in that environment, And it is the most wondrous place, the holiest place there is to be. And I was overwhelmed by that experience. I stayed for just a few minutes because it was so overwhelming, When I walked out into the parking lot that evening, I looked up at this guy and I said, hey, big guy, I'd really like to have that experience. And that was the night that my daughter was conceived. Pay attention. Pay attention. And this is what we do when we start to take away all this outside stuff. See, I'm bodily and mentally different from 90% of the people out there. And I can't live in the material world. I mean, I can pretend to, but I can't stand it. At some point, it's like ashes in my mouth. I need something of depth and weight. And where do I find that depth and weight? I find it in Alcoholics Anonymous. the place that I was awakened. You know, I drank away my soul, and then my sponsor worked the steps with me, and it returned. So I'm a guy that you'll see walking down the street just about any day. You know, I talked to you about being a geek. I can't take care of myself. I'm living in a car if I'm lucky. I walk around looking for cigarette butts and change, trying to get enough to get through a day. Nobody's wants to be around me. And now because of you, what happens is I'm the kind of guy that I get called when children are born. And I get invited into situations that no man ever wants to go into. An example is I was at home, and this is probably, I think Jessica was maybe 2-3 years old. Oh yeah, I just started the coffee bar down at Long Beach City College. And I get a call from my a friend, a guy that he knew in AA. His son had come down with leukemia, 8-year-old kid. He was 5 the first time he got it. And the family did all the right stuff. The kid went into remission, and now it was back. And they were down at Miller's Children's Hospital. And Bill called me up, and he said, I don't know what to do. I'm frightened. I'm an AA guy. I'm a member of the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, and I have been taught that what I do is I show up. I can't make things right or wrong, but I can help make them sober. So I come into this place. I come into this beautiful hospital, and I walk into this room, and here's this child, and his family worked for this really wonderful company that was self-insured, and they had all the money in the world in their insurance program. And so they're basically keeping this kid alive as a test case. And I talked to the kid that first night when there was a moment. And I said, look, kid, I don't know you. And I know you're really, really sick. But I'm an AA guy, and your dad needs help staying sober. So when I come here, you don't have to be worried about me. You don't have to be nice to me. You don't have to engage with me like you do with a lot of other people. I'm just here to support your dad. And so I, you know, imagine this. I am going by this hospital every day when I go to work. And this guy is being this sober dad, and he's showing up every other day, and his ex-wife showing up the other day, and they're spending the time with this kid. And I'm there every day. And I have always had, before, you know, probably my last 2 or 3 years of alcoholism, I'd always had a pretty cool relationship with God as I understood God. And I got sober, and I get, you know, just wonderfully filled. And as I kept going to this place, what happened is that my understanding of God just started to get pulverized. And it couldn't accept what was going on. I mean, I'd heard about the suffering of Jesus. As far as I read it, the guy did whatever he wanted, and he had a bad weekend at the end. You know? Every place he went, there was a party. Do you notice that? You know, I mean, he really did. I mean, they were always having a good time. And my mind can't wrap itself around what's going on with this kid. And my understanding and my connection with my higher power left. And it was devastating. And I couldn't even describe it to anybody. I couldn't talk about it. It just was gone. And I kept showing up and doing all the stuff that I was normally doing. But it's still, when I talk about it, my chest still gets tight. And I didn't run away. And the reason I didn't run away is because I was trained in AA to keep showing up. A lot of the things that I do have nothing to do with me being wonderful. It's just that I'm showing up. And one night I walked out of the hospital. It was probably one of the worst nights that I'd been there. You know, and we didn't spend a lot of time in the room. What I'd do is I'd come in and I'd get the dad and I'd take him out and he'd yell and scream and cry. And I'd get him to the point where he could go back in and be there for his son. And I'm leaving the hospital, and they had night-blooming jasmine all around this hospital. And when I walked out, I smelled it. And it washed through me and all the way out my toes. And it came back. But since that time, I have never tried to describe God to anybody again. Except that I can tell you how it smells for me. When we're working with others, one of the things that is a challenge is that many people have no spiritual training. I feel a lot of the times that bad spiritual training is better than none, because at least you got something that you can work with. But a lot of people, they don't have any spiritual connection. They don't have any thing with prayer. And then we start, you know, they come into this, obviously it's a Christian cult, you know, with our Serenity Prayer and our saying the Lord's Prayer. And then we get around to the third step prayer. And then they mumble something that somebody else has written. And of course, the prayer is, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Then just after this, it says, we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. That's the goal to shoot for, man, the alcoholic trifecta, by the way. My wife is all three. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. And then there's this line, which I love. The wording, of course, was quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. So what I'd like to invite you to do, we're going to go have lunch, and then we'll be back here I forget what time, 1:15. What I'd like to ask you to do is get by yourself for a couple of minutes and write your own third step prayer. Because one of the things that's been really, really helpful to me in working with others is having them write their own prayer. Because with many of them, it's the first time that they've ever prayed from their own selves. So write your own third step prayer, and then sometime over the next 24 hours, cut a guy out of the pack here, and go and say the prayer to him. Have somebody that's here witness your prayer. Okay? And, yes, sir? You can do it however you want. Yeah. Just a second. All right. Excuse me. I'm trying to get you to think outside of the box. I know that everybody in this room has done the third step correctly, and they know how to do it correctly. Okay? But what I'd like to do is just suggest that what you do is try this experiment and see how it works. And if you want to do it on your knees, that's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to do. Dr. Bob used to have guys get down on their knees and pray, but many times when he did the third step with a guy, they'd be sitting in chairs across from each other, and he had these big, long legs and these bony knees, and he'd lock his legs around theirs, and he'd hold their hands, and he'd look them in the eye when they did it. So there's a few different postures that are available to us. This is referred to as the Dr. Bob leg lock. So anyway, gentlemen, thank you very much, and I'll see you back at 1:15.